supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we have a question from across the pond and then some later on in the show today. A listener in Australia, where it appears we are somewhat popular, wants to know how to garden without tick problems. We'll reveal the tick control strategies that work on all continents and a couple that are precise to where you live after lots of your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Tate, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks, Mike. How are you today?
I am just ducky, Tate. How are you?
Phenomenally fantastic to be talking to you and talking gardens during winter.
Okay. All right. Where is Tate nominally fantastic?
In Collingswood, New Jersey, southern New Jersey.
The Garden State. What can we do for you, Tater?
Well, Mike, I planted some fruiting cherry trees, a Montemorseri cherry and a white Rainier cherry about 10 years ago, and they've done fine, but I planted them next to my stucco wall of my house, and I did that with the hopes of espaliering them.
Espalier.
Espalier.
No, yeah. No, espalier.
It's
like the only impressive word I can pronounce correctly. So I'm going to keep doing it over and over again.
Good. Well, you're going to do it better than I am. So I just never found the time to do it. And the trees have grown and they're beautiful and they fruit every year. And the squirrels and robins love that. I get a little bit in between them. But one of the trees, the white Rainier, has grown approximately 12 foot up just above our single story roof there. And then the other one is just about 10 foot. And they're doing great. But I guess I'm ready to prune them. I'm ready to try and tie them to the wall. I just would love to top it off. I don't know if that could be done.
Oh, I'm so glad you're asking this question, because with any dwarf or semi-dwarf fruit tree, or even a standard size fruit tree, is what's called creating a new central leader. And all that means is you take the tallest branch that goes straight up, which is a branch that's not going to fruit for you, but it's going to make parts of the tree much more difficult to reach. Every year, theoretically, you should be cutting off that tallest branch and creating, quote, a new central leader, which would be the now tallest branch. So that's not only acceptable and not harmful, it's actually in the book as something that you've been supposed to be doing pretty much since year one to help keep the tree in size. One of the things that espalier does, in addition to capturing the heat off of a wall behind it or just being purely decorative, is to make sure the tree spreads out in an umbrella-like shape instead of growing straight up. Because the more lateral branches you have that are lower to the ground, the easier it is to care for the tree, to pick the ripe fruit, to thin the developing fruits, and to get rid of any fruits that develop brown rot on them throughout the season. So that's absolutely called for, much less anything else.
Well, I have not done that, and I am behind the game here. So is there any correction methods that I can take?
You say you've been growing these trees for 10 years. You haven't pruned them yet?
Correct.
They got to be pretty muddy. You know?
Well, I'll tell you, I spent probably 3 days picking the Montemorseri cherries because of the what you're describing, because of the, you know, the outgrowth of them. They're fruiting tremendously, but they're just wildly. I don't know. I mean, am I able to bring them back into control at this point?
Well, yes and no. When you're talking cherry trees, there really are no well-behaved varieties. Most of them, even if they say they're semi-dwarf, they're going to grow up to a standard if they're fruiting cherries. And these are sour cherries, right?
The white Rainier is a sweet cherry.
Well, that's unusual to be able to grow a sweet cherry in your region, but perhaps the fact that it's nailed to a wall and it gets all that extra heat in the winter could be helping it. So what you want to do, really, you're pruning for two reasons. You're pruning to keep the tree under control in height. You really don't mm-hmm. want to control the outward spread because that's where you're going to get all your fruit.
Okay.
So you always want to be cutting out that big first central leader. If you look at a cluster of branches where you really can't see through there anymore, especially because they're up against a wall, yeah, you want to be selectively taking out some branches to make sure there's good airflow in there and you don't get disease. But otherwise, with this kind of a tree, with a cherry tree, you're okay being lazy the first bunch of years.
Okay.
It sounds like your experiment has worked. Keep cutting back those top branches going straight up because they're not going to be fruiting branches anyway. Try to keep the size under control. That's what I would have advised you to do for the first bunch of years. Try to keep the height under control. But otherwise, in the spring, just cut out a couple of branches where it's just too much of a thick, where it's Sleeping Beauty's castle in there.
Okay, good. Perfect. Hey, Mike, thank you so kindly.
Oh, my pleasure.
And your advice.
All right, good luck, sir.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Christy, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you doing?
I am just ducky today. Christy, how are you?
I'm doing well.
And where is Christy doing well?
I'm doing well in Bahama, North Carolina.
Oh, okay. Very good. What can we do for you down there?
Well, about a year ago, my husband and I made a plot about 12 by 20 feet, trying to make a garden, kind of got ambitious about it. Put a whole bunch of our horse manure. It was actually composted horse manure into it and tilled it up. And then we just got too busy with other things. It grew a whole bunch of weeds, so we pulled them, and then they grew more weeds. And so then we did some solarization over the past year. And now we're hoping to start the garden, but I've been listening to your podcast and realized that horse manure is probably not the best thing for vegetables.
Correct. Just because you have a lot of something doesn't mean it's what you should be using.
Right.
Now, why are you flat earth gardening?
Because I hadn't been listening to your podcast yet.
Okay. And how do you think you solarized?
What I did was I got some clear greenhouse plastic and pulled it as tightly as I could over the area and put rocks on the edges so it wouldn't blow away. I sprayed it down first with water. It's been like that for over last summer and through the winter even. So.
Okay. To truly solarize, you have to till up the soil, get rid of the big clumps of rocks and big clumps of plants, level it perfectly, saturate it with water beyond belief till it can accept no water anymore. Then, yes, stretch 1 to 3 mil clear plastic over top and make sure that that is held down tightly on all sides and let that cook all summer long. And where you are in the Carolinas, that summer heat will destroy any weed seeds or diseases or any problems you have in the soil.
Okay.
So maybe you achieved it, maybe you didn't. What do you want to grow?
Well, I do want to grow like potatoes, tomatoes, zucchini, bell peppers, salad greens.
Build yourself a couple of raised beds. Humor me. Go to our website. Go to youbetyourgarden.org. Go to Garden Answers A to Z. Go to raised beds, R. And see the dimensions, the framing options you have, what to fill them with. Build yourself just a couple of raised beds, just a couple of 4x8 raised beds, and grow your cucumbers and your peppers and your tomatoes in the raised beds. Then leave a couple of areas out in the open. If your horse manure is completely composted, that is, it has no smell whatsoever. It has no heat. It doesn't look like what it used to. You can't see any of the old bedding. You can use that to fertilize sweet corn, potatoes, lawns, even to a lesser amount, spinach and salad greens, because these are not fruiting crops. What you want to keep the horse manure away from is fruiting crops like peppers and cucumbers and tomatoes. That will give you big plants with few fruits. And any horse manure that's not completely composted is going to give you weeds. But so is tilling. Anytime you till the soil, you're going to expose bazillions of weed seeds to sunlight, which is the trigger for germination. So the tilling alone will guarantee the field will be nothing but weeds that you'll battle all summer. That's one reason we tell people to build the raised beds. They fill them with topsoil and the compost. They never till them. You won't see a single weed in your raised beds.
Okay.
But unless you want to spend the rest of your life playing around with weeds, build raised beds, grow in those, never till them. And if you want to have some fun, use your composted horse manure to grow sweet corn. You will grow the biggest, beautiful, sweetest ears of corn possible. If you have a lawn, fertilize your lawn with composted horse manure. You're down south, so you would fertilize in the spring. Use the composted horse manure for your potatoes. Don't have too heavy a hand or you could cause problems, but they like that as a fertilizer. Anything that likes a lot of nitrogen. But okay. Don't use it on fruiting crops and no more tilling.
Okay.
All right.
Well, thank you, Mike.
All right. Good luck to you.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and reiterate my plans for the upcoming Philadelphia Flower Show. I'll be doing my annual organic question and answer period at the Gardener's Studio on the Flower Show 4 at 4 o'clock on Wednesday, March 7th, and that lecture is free with Flower Show admission. I also want to remind everybody that I had to change the date of a different upcoming event and that I will now return to the wonderful Brandywine 100 Library on Thursday evening, February 27th. So get it right. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And High Caliper Growing, creators of the original Smart Pot, Big Bag Bed, and other fabric growing containers made in the USA. Remember, the container you use affects the plants you grow. SmartPots.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, it is about that time of year when ticks start to stir out in the woods in our garden and get ready to get their first meal off of us. How can we protect ourselves? Well, we're going to use a listener's question from Australia to reveal how ticks are a problem the world over and the common things we can do to prevent them. In the meantime, though, lots of your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Stephanie, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi.
Hello, Stephanie. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I am just fine. Where is Stephanie good?
I'm in Flatbush, Brooklyn.
Okay, very good. Forget about it, right?
Yeah.
So what can we do for Stephanie in Flatbush?
Well, I have a bit of a a jungle going on in my house, so I have a lot of different indoor plants, and they seem to have contracted some kind of problem that I can't totally identify, so I was wondering if you could help me.
Sure. What's going on?
I have a group of plants where some of the leaves are yellowing and the tips are very dry. It doesn't seem like in a lack of water kind of way. It's kind of like turning into this papery crepe dryness at the tips.
Right.
And then I have another set where I thought they were dusty at first, but at closer inspection, it looks like that the color is being drained from them in this kind of like very tiny speckled way, like as if it had little tiny watermarks or dust on it.
Okay.
And on those same plants, it has like mid-leaf browning in like little circles.
Okay, so what kind of light do these plants get?
They get pretty good light. I mean, most of them are in south-facing windows. They get a good amount of light.
And are there any heat vents or radiators near them?
No, I've moved them all away from any kind of place where there's a draft or any kind of vent.
How do you water them?
I water them with a watering can.
Right. How often?
Every week I check the soil. Like I try to dig my hand into the soil to see if it's damp or not.
Mm-hmm.
And so every week I do that.
Yeah, but after a week, depending on how long you're poking down, even a waterlogged plant, the top of the soil would be dry by then.
Oh, okay.
Now, do these containers have drainage?
Yes, they do have drainage.
And do they have saucers underneath them to keep the water off the carpet or the floor?
Yes, they do.
And does water collect in the saucers?
It does. I'll let the water drain all the way through. And then when it seems like it's not soaking up any more water, I dump the water out.
Okay. And do you feed them?
I do. I was using this all-purpose 20-20-20.
Oh, my goodness.
Is that too much?
Well, it's not too much if you're making an artillery shell. 20-20-20 would be armor-piercing. That's not a joke. It is the same nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium that's used in artillery shells and bullets. Anytime you want to feed plants gently, you look at those numbers on the label, and you want single numbers. And you don't want them to be even. You don't want, like, 999 even. You want something like a 312, a nice, gentle plant food that supplies some nutrients, but it's not overwhelming the plants.
Oh, okay.
I think the biggest thing here is overwatering. So there's two ways to tell if your house plants need water or not. Now, in the wintertime, especially if they're not near a heat vent or a radiator, they're not growing very much, if at all, and they're using water very lightly. They also can't use that chemical fertilizer because they're not growing fast. So the chemical fertilizer is just building up salt deposits around the roots.
Mm.
So never feed a house plant in the wintertime unless it's an indoor lemon or lime tree. But something like a wandering Jew or a spider plant or mother-in-law's tongue or Schefflera, those things should never be fed over the winter. Only in the summer, and generally only if they go outside. My house plants have never been fed, and they've been in that window for 20 years. So, you know, you can go out and you can buy cute little creatures that you can stick in the pots that'll tell you if they need water or not. But one easy way to do it is just get a chopstick and slide it down into the soil, let it sit in the pot for a couple of minutes, and then bring it out and feel the bottom. If the bottom of the chopstick is wet, the roots of the plants are still sitting in water. And those roots need to dry out in between waterings. The other way to do this is to rock the plant. When you get the plant really saturated, rock the pot. Just rock it back and forth, and you'll see how heavy it is. As long as that pot remains heavy, it does not need more water. When the pot rocks really easily back and forth, and the pot seems noticeably lighter, that's the time to water.
Okay.
in a houseplant, the roots will go all the way down to the drainage hole. So as long as it's still wet at the bottom, that plant doesn't need water yet. It's very good for plants to dry out in between waterings. And there's a lot of bad advice out there, water when the top of the plant feels dry. Well, that's ridiculous.
Yeah, that's ridiculous. All of them say that. They say like the 1 to 2 inches down, like I thought I was really digging deep in there.
No, it's what's downstairs that counts. It's what's in the basement.
Okay.
If you got a wet basement, you don't need more water.
Got it. That makes sense.
Okay, Steph?
Okay. All right. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you. Good luck to you.
Okay, bye.
1-888-346-9499. Neil, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike.
Hey, Neil. How are you?
I'm doing great, thanks.
And where is Neil great?
I'm in Boyertown, PA, Pennsylvania, south of Allentown, north of Philadelphia.
Okay, very good. What can I do you for?
Well, recently on one of your broadcasts, I heard you talking about the spotted lanternfly infestation.
Right.
And also trying to control it by removing Tree of Heaven or Atlantis trees.
Right.
And after the discussion, what I was commenting on was there was nothing I heard about treating the actual stump of the Tree of Heaven. And my experience has been if you cut one of those trees down, for every tree you cut down, you're going to have 100 sprouts come up from the roots, sometimes, 100 feet away from the main tree. So my question and my comment really is, what's your advice in terms of controlling the spread of this tree after you cut it down?
Well, there's several aspects here. First of all, you are correct in the trees like Atlantis and black locust and some others will resprout from their stump, some more aggressively than others. But none of them can handle repeated cutting. If you have an area that you really want to clear, and this works for bamboo as well, repeated cutting without allowing enough leaf formation to achieve photosynthesis eventually starves the root system and new sprouts stop coming up. Now, when you're dealing with this new imported pest, the spotted lanternfly, one of the things the researchers have stressed is you don't want to get rid of every tree of heaven. You want to leave a couple behind as a trap crop.
We have that, yes.
So, for instance, if you get out there and aggressively take down all the big boys and you leave 4 or 5 perfectly spaced trees, then theoretically the next season you can destroy the infested trees. And by selectively allowing some more to come up from the root system, you can have your new trap crop of trees. But when it comes to plants that are overly aggressive in constantly regrowing from their stump, one thing we learned from, and I think it's up in the frozen north where they have this problem with a tree called the buckthorn. This is a nasty, aggressive, invasive. And they were not having any luck with the chemical plan of painting the stump with herbicide. So somebody came up with the brilliant idea of when a new stump would come up, they would nail a coffee can over top of it. And that proved to be remarkably effective. Of course, there's no cost for any kind of herbicide. There's no overspray. There's no danger to the amphibians in the area or to the humans, and it seems like it's a remarkably effective way to prevent regrowth. Now, it wouldn't work on running bamboo, obviously, because so many new culms come up in any given area. But when you're talking about trees that will mostly regrow from the stump you cut, it's remarkably effective.
Well, these trees are huge. They wouldn't make a coffee can big enough to fit over the stump.
Once things get established that heavily, then you have to drop back to the rope-a-dope. You have to do what you do for bamboo. And I see this in action. My neighbors and I inherited a clump of bamboo that's between our two houses.
Okay.
And it can't come into the road, although it tries. It can't cross over to my property because there's a stream and they're like vampires, bamboo. They can't cross running water. There's a big rock formation behind it. But then on the other side, on my neighbor's side, there's Willard, who's Pennsylvania Dutch. And he just mows it every week, keeps those young culms under control. And there has been no spreading of the growth on to his area. Sometimes the simplest solutions are the easy ones, but it is basic science. Once you begin to starve the root system, the entire plant must die. And in the case of a tree of heaven or a grove of bamboo, it might be one gigantic plant showing off in a number of different places.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is, you know, to just keep cutting new growth just as the new leaves are opening up before they can achieve any sunlight and process it, cutting them off, and that root is growing smaller and smaller and weaker and weaker. And, of course, any mid-sized trees, you definitely do the coffee can trick.
Okay. So you said
paint cans, man. Paint cans if the stump is big. Come on, think big.
Okay. Well, that'll be a project indefinitely until the things die off. And then hopefully that'll help the spread of this terrible, terrible invasive insect.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, Mike. I appreciate it.
All right. Good luck, man.
Thank you much. Bye bye now.
1-888-346-9499. Carolyn, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello.
Hello, Carolyn. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
And where is Carolyn Fine?
In Norwood, Delaware County, Pennsylvania.
Okay, very good. What can we do for Caroline in Delaware County?
I have a dwarf peach tree that's about 9 years old. It's in a very large pot. It's in a very nice sheltered area for the winter, especially. It stays that place all year long. It's like a L shape of a wooden fence, and it's against the fence. So it gets morning sun. It's facing east, in fact, where it is. But this winter, it did something it never did before. I've had it for 9 years, and this winter, I looked at it, and I thought it was icicles all over it, but it wasn't. It was sap. And the sap came down about an inch, just like icicles, everywhere. And it was a jelly-like sap. So it wasn't a liquid. It mm-hmm. was more of a solid, like jello.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, everybody who grows peach trees knows exactly what you got.
Oh, what do I have?
Peach tree borers, insects that bore into the trees and make holes and weaken the trees, and then the sap runs, and you get a mess, and the tree is weakened and will probably soon be dead. Now, why were you growing a peach tree in a pot?
Because it was a dwarf peach tree. I've had it for 9 years in the pot, and where it sits, it's just beautiful, especially when it blooms. And I always get about 7 or 8 peaches, and it's the fight between me and the squirrel who gets it first. But it makes many little peaches, but some of them all fall off by themselves, and then about 7 or 8 stay on and get nice and big.
Okay. Is it sitting on a stone patio or on a lawn? Or
in the front of the fence there, I have about a 3-foot wide area that's soil with stones on top.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's where my irises grow. But the pot is sitting on top of those stones on the soil area.
Okay. It's not the ideal situation. The plant has been stressed over winter by having its roots freeze. That stress and lack of proper care has probably led to the attack of the borers. Now, I will tell you that although very few people would attempt to grow a peach tree in a pot, you would still follow the basic rules. In the early spring, when the tree started growing again, you would prune off some of the older branches, some of the top branches to reduce the height and to keep the center open.
And, oh, I do, yes. Mm-hmm.
Oh, good. And then once those baby peaches started to form, you would not wait for them to fall. You would actually choose a good half to two-thirds of them, and you would pull them off yourself.
Okay. Is there anything I can do about this boar stuff before it kills it?
No, the tree is three-quarters dead. Peach trees are the most difficult trees to raise in our area, commercially or organically. And the fact that this was growing in a pot weakened it even further. Oddly enough, facing east could have also weakened it, because sometimes what happens is in the winter time, you'll get really intense sun from the east and you've got white rocks underneath holding that heat. You may have warmed the tree too much over winter and accidentally weakened it. Some peach tree orchardists will actually paint the barks of their peach trees white over the winter to reflect the sun so the tree doesn't warm up too much. Obviously, there's no reason to do anything now. Let's wait to the spring. You may get a really nice run of peach flowers. But then typically after that, right around the time that the young peaches start to form, the branches are going to turn black and die.
Oh, goodness. So I can't save it at all.
Well, no. I mean, it is already halfway through its natural lifespan. It was in an unnatural situation, and it sounds like it's been infested by hundreds of borers. There are many times where we can't save plants. In commercial farming, 55% survival is considered a huge financial success.
Huh.
If you want to consider replanting in that area, just put the tree in the ground and get rid of the rocks.
Okay.
All right.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Good luck.
Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce a couple more of my upcoming appearances. In addition to the Brandywine 100 Library on Thursday evening, February 27th, I will speak at the Haverford Home and Garden Show on Sunday, April 15th, at the Bay Shore Center in Port Norris, New Jersey on Thursday evening, April 26th, and at St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Exton, PA on Saturday, May 12th. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back to tackle your ticks and take more of your ticklish phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And High Caliper Growing, creators of the original Smart Pot, Big Bag Bed, and other fabric growing containers made in the USA. Remember, the container you use affects the plants you grow. SmartPots.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we will get to a question about tick control from Australia. Is everything the same in how we try to keep these little bloodsuckers off us from one continent to another? We will answer all of those questions and get you ready to not get bitten this spring after a couple more of your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Ben, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Ben. How are you, sir?
Oh, I'm good, other than my Bermuda.
Okay, where is Ben good?
I'm good in Oklahoma City area.
Okay, very good. What can we do for Ben in Oklahoma?
I've got these raised bed gardens. I made them so that they're really easy for the kids to reach. So they're 2 feet tall, which I know is excessive for just the root structures, but I just wanted to make it really easy for the kids to be able to reach without too much kneeling or crawling or
sure.
Or
no, it's great.
The gardens or anything.
Taller the
so,
better.
Good. The problem I've got is I've got Bermuda all through my backyard.
Right.
And I'm afraid that with how invasive it is, it's going to recognize the water that's coming down through the garden beds and then just come right up and infest the entire thing.
But that has not happened.
Well, I haven't even put dirt in the garden beds yet.
Oh.
I've built the boxes.
Okay. Are the boxes on top of Bermuda?
They will be, yes.
Oh, okay. So good. So you actually called in time instead of after the fact. So here's what you do when you're getting ready to do this. Now, I wish we had talked in the fall because, as you know, your Bermuda's probably tan and brown right now, right?
Right, yeah.
So it's at its weakest now. If you have a nice day where there's not a lot of moisture, here's what I'm going to recommend. Now, do you have the boxes in place?
Yes.
I would go out and I would get a lawnmower and I would do the opposite of what I always tell people. I would lower it to its lowest possible cutting setting and I would scalp the area where those boxes are going to be. I want to see dirt blowing out the back of the motor. And then I would take heavy cardboard, like the kind of cardboard you'd get a refrigerator shipped in.
Right.
And I would cover the earth underneath the raised bed frame with a couple of inches all around on the outside. And then especially because you've made them so high, I would then simply fill them with a mixture of good quality compost and rich screened black topsoil. You know, maybe a little perlite in there to increase the drainage. But with the combination of scalping when the Bermuda is weak and then the cardboard, I think you would stand a really good chance of keeping it away. Now, you're correct. If you had simply dropped dirt in on top of live Bermuda grass, you would have had the weirdest spectacle ever. In a year or two, you would have had green Bermuda grass coming up out of the top of your beds, but you would have had these weird 2-foot-long white shoots underneath that had never been exposed to sunlight. That would be really creepy. But if you start out with a barrier and you extend that barrier beyond the edges of the raised bed frames, I might even get a heavy-duty staple gun and some more cardboard and make reinforcements around the outside edges. Now, maybe 3-4 years from now, you'll have a rogue single strand of a Bermuda coming up in an area that you missed or something like that. But because you've got so much dirt in there, you've got all the room your plants are going to need. And I think you've got a great barrier against invasion. Do not use weed fabric down in the bottom. Weed fabric, by definition, has to have tiny little holes so that air and water can pass through. And the grass comes up right through those holes.
Right.
That's why you want a solid layer of cardboard down there. You don't have to go crazy, and the cardboard will eventually deteriorate, but the Bermuda is going to be happy just growing in between the raised bed lanes.
Somebody at our extension office suggested putting a plastic barrier around the outside and then just covering that with mulch.
No, the Bermuda's just going to go underneath that.
Okay.
And make sure that your raised bed frames are dropped into the earth. Make sure they're an inch deep into the surrounding soil so that when the Bermuda on the outside hits the sides, it can't just accidentally go under. It'll have to try to go up. And then you'll just weed whack the outsides of the frames.
Right.
Okay.
I'm using that corrugated roofing material.
For what?
For the sides. I framed it out with cedar and then screwed that corrugated material onto the sides for the structure of it.
What was wrong with the cedar?
It was just expensive.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah, I have no opinion there. Make sure it's reinforced so the weight of the soil doesn't push it out and bow it. But that's fine. Again, just make sure there's a good layer of thick cardboard in the bottom, that the frames are sunk an inch or two into the earth, that you scalp it beforehand and you keep weed whacking any Bermuda that gets near the outsides of your beds.
Okay, great. Hey, thanks, Mike.
All right.
I appreciate you.
Good luck, sir.
Thanks. I'm going to need it against the Bermuda.
No, no, you're going to do fine. Don't worry. Just make sure you keep weed whacking.
Okay, I will.
Take care.
Thanks, bye.
1-888-346-9499. Sarah, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being had, Sarah. Where are you?
I'm up in Londonderry, New Hampshire.
Oh, that sounds lovely. What can we do you for?
Well, my question is, we built a home here about 3 years ago in a newer development, and we decided about 2 years ago to fence in the entire backyard with a 6-foot white vinyl privacy fence. We live towards the top of a hill, and it's very windy, gets a lot of direct sun because there wasn't a lot of landscaping here. And I've been struggling with what to plant in front of the fence that will be able to tolerate the wind and the sun and fill in nicely over the next few years so the yard looks more inviting from the street.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about 6 foot tall and about 8 foot wide panels, so something to plant, a shrub or something like that in front of each panel.
Well, you have adequate rainfall where you are, and I hear what you're saying about the wind and the other stresses. One of my go-to plants for privacy, and we're really talking about privacy plants here, even though it's to hide a privacy fence, mm-hmm. I would really urge you to look at large ornamental grasses.
Oh, okay.
They're very showy. They grow very quickly. They're very perennial. You know, you plant some nice trees out there that resist the wind and everything like that. Those are going to be slow growers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's just the nature of the beast. Something that can take that kind of stress is a slow grower. Whereby ornamental grasses can be very showy, can grow very quickly in a season, and they fill in laterally. They're fat little puppies, if you know mm-hmm. what I mean. You know, they're going to grow out, and they're going to fill that space much more quickly than other plants, and they thrive under the kind of conditions that you're talking about. The only thing I would suggest is when you're picking your plants, go for drama, go for color, but make sure the plumes of the grasses don't distribute invasive seeds. There's one or two ornamental grasses that should not be used because they can spread and become invasive, but many of them are sterile or don't produce seeds. And it just sounds like it would be perfect to look at from the street. And it's not like you putting in a row of arborvitae and spending $1 million and then number five
right.
dies.
And that's what I was actually, arborvitaes or Rosa Sharon was what I was thinking, but I didn't even think of ornamental grass.
Ornamental grass, if for no other reason, it's four season. Mm-hmm. You're going to get the full coverage. It's going to look great in the winter with the snow around it and on it. It looks spectacular when it begins to green up again in the spring. In the spring, you have your choice to prune away the old brown grass or just leave it in place for a real variegated look. I think it's the most underutilized type of plant for this kind of situation.
Great. And I've seen them at the nurseries before, but I get overwhelmed with the amount of choices mm-hmm. there are of ornamental grass. Do you recommend a certain type or?
I don't, because I don't live in Londonderry.
Okay.
So what I would say is you contact your local extension office and get their bulletin. I guarantee they have one on the best ornamental grasses for the region. And they'll be able to direct you to ones that are not only very hardy for your region, perhaps maybe even have some native roots, but will also be good for wildlife. I know any ornamental grass is going to be a great shelter for birds, but others may even provide other functions. So, yeah, get some good local advice and then pick a good, high-quality local nursery and let them give you some advice as well.
All right, great. Well, I'll work on that in the spring, and I'll send you a picture to show you what it looks like.
All right, sounds good.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week. Tick protection on both sides of the world. Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden. Please get us started by reading this week's long-distance question.
It sure is, Mike. Natasha in Queensland, Australia, where she says the show has a great following, writes, "I have a phobia of ticks. The little suckers totally freak me out. I've read your amazing posts about the use of permethrin spray products to create protective clothing, but what would you recommend for the skin? I'm also keen to start a good-sized veggie patch, but can't stand the thought of them being on the food I'm going to eat. Any ideas?" Wait a second, they have ticks in Australia?
Oh, yeah, they do. I had to look it up, but ticks exist on every continent except Antarctica. Australia is home to around 75 different species, many of which transmit disease, but with a higher incidence of some conditions like spotted fever that are kind of rare here in the States, and a lower incidence of others. Confirmed cases of Lyme disease, for instance, are so rare that there's controversy over whether it even exists in Australia.
But is tick prevention the same?
Mostly. Ticks everywhere still have the same basic habit. They hang out in moist, brushy areas and wait for a host to come by close enough for them to hop on and attach. Then they'll move around on the host for a couple hours before they settle in, and then you still have a couple more hours before the tick begins exchanging fluids with you.
Ugh. I'm with Natasha. The little suckers freak me out, too.
As they do everybody. But, you know, ticks are the opposite of spiders. Although many people fear spiders, and a good number of people have full-blown arachnophobia, spiders are very beneficial creatures that prey on serious pests. And despite what the urban legends say, human spider bites are rare. Ticks, however, are the reverse. They're just plain bad. And yes, I find them creepy as well. But this is the time of year when a lot of people are beginning to spend a lot more time outdoors, and it's crucial that we review the basic rules of tick protection for them.
Okay, let's begin with Natasha's question about permethrin-based clothing sprays.
All right, first the big disclaimer. Permethrin is a synthetic pesticide derived from the botanical insecticide pyrethrum, which is isolated from the crushed petals of a specific group of flowers that have been variously classified as daisies, asters, and/or chrysanthemums. Now, normally, we would never recommend the use of a synthetic pesticide for anything, but permethrin falls under the common sense pest control banner. When used for tick control, we don't spray it into the environment, onto plants, or apply it to our skin.
We just use it on our clothing to repel ticks, which are otherwise difficult to control.
Exactly right. Permethrin is tick kryptonite. When applied to clothing, it repels them. If they try to attach themselves to the clothing anyway, it kills them. When I first learned about it, you would go to a store that specialized in hunting, fishing, and camping supplies and buy the spray in pump or aerosol form and spray the clothes you intended to wear out in the garden or the woods with it. Again, there's never a need to put anything on your skin. For ticks, treated clothing is the ideal protection. And even if you're not the type of person who minds the idea of absorbing chemical toxins into your body, forget about DEET. That works for mosquitoes, but it does not work for ticks.
You later found a company that sells professionally treated clothing, right?
Yes, Insect Shield. They originally supplied tick-proof uniforms for the military and then branched out into the consumer wear line. I have several pairs of their treated socks, long-sleeve shirts, and pants. And the only time I ever find a tick attached is when I forget to put those special clothes on.
But can they ship to Australia?
Thankfully, yes. I called them yesterday and they shipped to every country except Canada.
Okay, so wear permethrin-treated clothing. What else?
Well, here in the States, mouse and deer control is essential, as they're the primary hosts of the ticks that carry disease. Keeping deer out of your landscape will protect both you and your plants. Mouse control is even more important. Many so-called deer ticks never saw a deer, but they have all spent part of their life cycle on the white-footed field mouse. Battery-powered electric mouse traps are a great way to keep American gardens mouse-free without fear of harming creatures like birds with old-fashioned snap traps.
And in Australia?
It's the bandicoot you must control. These marsupials are the size of rabbits, look like rats, and are the number one carriers of ticks in Australia. I would strongly recommend fencing them out of any vegetable gardens. Again, for protection of the plants as well as the people. Same with kangaroos, wallabies, and other exotic creatures that seem so amusing to us. They're all potential tick carriers in Australia. So critter proofing is going to go a long way towards making any landscape safe.
Wherever you live, keep brushy areas to a minimum. If you have a meadow, don't walk through it without protective clothing and or a thorough tick check afterwards. Keep the areas you frequent as dry as possible. Ticks need moisture, so always irrigate at the base of plants. Don't wet the leaves, and don't water early in the evening or at night.
Again, all good advice for people and plants. Well, that sure was some interesting information about ticks the whole world round now, wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, with links to lots of other tick prevention tips, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to brandish a bandicoot if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499. Or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, you're wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please include your location, especially if you are certain that we do not need it. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you'll find the answers to all those questions you were going to ask us. Audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our vice president of production is Terry Murray. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Our engineer is Al Banks. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Webmasters Larissa Sapko and Rich Banowitz keep our website turned upside down. Aussie Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY FM in Philadelphia. Our associate producer of Production Association is Brett Rader. Our bloomin' onion of an editor is Al Banks. I'm your host, International Mike McGrath, and I'll remain worldwide until I can see you again next week. Low bush blueberries may be the tastiest fruits, but are you cold enough to grow them? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll discuss the original blueberries and what it takes to taste them. Plus your fabulous phone calls. That's on the next You Bet Your Garden.